Welcome to Jack Theology, back for another episode, three in a row, feeling good.
Here we go, we might be back in a rhythm now.
Yeah, it feels good to have a rhythm. How's it going? How's life for you this past week?
Yeah, things are good around here. Things are busy, very busy. I don't think that really ever probably changes for a pastor. You're always doing something. You're working weekends. You're working during the week. You're flexing to the basis of whatever the need is. And I find that whenever I do disconnected online ministry, more so than in-person ministry, it's the same. In fact, it's probably worse in some ways because 24/7, 365, people have contact with you all of the time, and everything is connected through the internet. But yeah, the typical pastor complaint there, right? How are you?
Yeah. I'd say same. I haven't had a day off in quite a long time, and so I've been trying to take one, and I booked a day at the monastery tomorrow thinking that I would at least get some rest, but it's looking like maybe that won't happen. So maybe I'll have to punt till Thursday. But
sorry to hear that.
Such is the life of ministry, as you say, and the life of a father with four kids as well. So yeah. I had a kid with a birthday this week, and so he's having a bunch of friends over. And as soon as we're done with this, he'll probably have 20 of his finest friends in our home. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Enjoy that. I'm not sure which is more difficult to handle, 20 boys or 20 girls, but it's a lot no matter what.
Yeah, they're just different issues, right? I've learned now that I have a girl, there's a lot of drama that comes with many girls together. And when there's many boys, things break. So yeah, the fun stuff. We had some good dialogue, I thought, last week about the Reformation, and we called it the newish, or you titled it the newish Reformation. And it came up in our topic about Paul and Jesus and the differences. And so I want to dive into that some today. But before we dive into that, it just made me think, because about the Reformation, kind of close the loop. You know, I think the term that we use today is deconstruction. And it's fascinating because a lot of the folks that don't want to reform, don't want to change, make the word deconstruction the boogeyman.
Yeah, a real negative thing,
if you will. And it kind of feeds into this Paul and Jesus debate, because it seems like those that deconstruct or reform lean towards Jesus, and those that don't want to deconstruct or reform, they lean towards Paul. So I think it fits. So I don't know if you have a lot of thoughts on deconstruction. So I don't know if you could maybe summarize that for folks that are, they maybe not know what that is.
Yeah, summarize deconstruction.
Yeah.
It's tough because there is no kind of agreed upon definition for deconstruction, and everybody I think who kind of uses the word deconstruction oftentimes means something very different by it. For some people, it's a kind of positive word that is more just kind of breaking things into its pieces so you can look at them and do a, I think, maybe valid or better assessment on what all of those pieces are. For other people, it has a more negative sense, and they'll try to tie in deconstruction from Derrida and other philosophical places and try to kind of shoehorn those things in there. And you know, then you've got kind of this whole other group of people who, as they've done with many other words like CRT and woke, and these things are trying to kind of add baggage intentionally to the word in order to destroy the word. This is kind of the new way to cancel ideas and to cancel people, is to change definitions of words or destroy definitions of words. In general, though, I think deconstruction looks different for different people because different people take a different path. And so a lot of folks feel a lot more comfortable with a word like disentangling, or something that kind of implies you trying to unravel or split apart the things that are toxic from your faith, as we use the word deconstruction, and keep the things that are healthy, that are whole, that are Christ-centered. A lot of folks have a lot of discomfort with that. In fact, I go to a church that is it's not a progressive church, but the minister is fairly kind of open-minded in the way he speaks about things and open-handed, not like a lot of conservative language, but used the term deconstruction in a very negative way this past Sunday. And I was like shocked. Like it took the breath out of me, because he doesn't speak negatively of same-sex attraction issues. He doesn't speak negatively of like Democratic Party. He doesn't speak negative. Like, he always kind of pulls the line back whenever he's talking about things in order to not alienate folks who might be on the margin of a Southern, you know, church. And with that, he didn't. And it just like sucked the air out of me and out of the room. And I was like, you just lost like a whole group of people here because you just threw that word out in a negative way. And people who are sitting there, or people who are wrestling, you totally alienated them. So I think, unfortunately, that word has become a culture war. And it shouldn't have been, I think, a culture war. And the fact that we're there says probably more about us than it says about the actual process of deconstruction.
Yeah, that's good. I think, you know, to give your pastor the benefit of a doubt, like, I think that there's some misunderstanding. It becomes the boogeyman. Maybe he hasn't done a lot of research on it and just kind of had the, you know, has heard things. Maybe, you know, the echo chamber maybe that he lives in fed him negative connotations. Because a lot of the negative connotations I see is that people who deconstruct, you know, take it to the Derrida philosophical end where it becomes nothing, right? And that's not what we're saying. Like, some people do that. Let's be clear. There are some that just, you know, their faith becomes nothing at the end of their deconstruction. But for most, and many, the vast majority, we deconstruct one aspect of theology or one aspect of a philosophy of ministry, of how we do church, and not everything, right? And for most of us, we keep Jesus. Let's be honest, when we deconstruct and we find Jesus, we're at the center of it all. And I think that's a beautiful thing. We'll talk about that more as we go here. And then the other thing that I hear a lot, and it's out there, is that we deconstruct, people deconstruct just so they can have sex, fill in the blank for sexuality. Like, it becomes a big thing, like this sexual thing. Like, well, you know, I've heard it from the big guys like Matt Chandler and some of those folks, you know, Stephen Furtick and others that are kind of big.
Yeah, I think it's just when you start assigning motives to people's spiritual journey, things get very, very messy. You know, God, Bible, very clear, and only God looks on the heart, you know, that man cannot judge the heart. And whenever you start assigning motives to things that people are doing spiritually, you're judging the heart of somebody else. And it just, I think it gets so messy whenever we start saying people deconstruct because they just want to sin. And you just made a really sinful statement. Maybe one or two, yeah. One or two people probably come to your church just to pick up people. One or two of the people probably work in your children's ministry just to, well, I probably just shouldn't say that. Like, there are people who come to your church in order to do things that are not appropriate for church. Does that mean you're just going to shut down and stop doing church at all and that everybody's there to do that? No. Same thing with deconstruction. Yes. There are probably a few people who go through deconstruction, and maybe the starting line was this way, but I don't think so. But at some point along the way, it became more about trying to justify some sort of thing that they wanted to justify. That's not the majority of the people who are walking through this. Just stop it. Just knock it off.
Yes. I went to my youth camp as a 18-year-old just to find women. And I invited friends to join me because I said there's going to be a lot of pretty women on this trip. So, yeah, there's always different motives.
It's amazing but what God can do on your journey and shift your – yeah, so maybe people do enter deconstruction to try to justify sin, and they end up finding Jesus along the way.
I'm sure it happens.
I don't think that most of the people who say this have really ever spoken to anybody who has gone through deconstruction. And I've certainly not read their Bibles. You know, I mean, Saul went through deconstruction and became Paul. Like, it just...
Yeah, I mean, throughout Scripture, right? I mean, Nicodemus, Jesus, all of the disciples. I mean...
You've heard it said, but I say, yeah.
Look at Thomas. I mean, Thomas is a huge... case study of deconstruction.
Thomas.
It's just filled. The scriptures are filled with folks that deconstruct.
Well, all of Christianity is a deconstruction of Judaism. Like, without deconstruction, you wouldn't be here. Your faith, you'd be Jewish still. Yes, which might be better. So after meeting some Christians, I'll take Judaism for $200, Alex. Maybe we need to go further back into our roots.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a common theme, or what Jesus and Paul really, I think, have in common philosophically. Obviously, there's a lot more in common than just this, but philosophically, they both are deconstructing Christianity from Judaism. They're highlighting what's different, what has changed, what's new. And so, yeah, for those that like speak out against it, I think you're missing it. And a lot of the reason why is because there's a fear, that deconstruct people that deconstruct are no longer going to value what they value in their church. Their kingdoms might come crumbling down because folks want to change. And so I think,
I
think this is what you're getting at. One more point is like, as pastors and leaders in the church, we should help facilitate that and lead our congregations in that process, not like your pastor did, speak against it or make those feel bad, kind of draw them in, and you don't have to fear it then if you lead them.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. People end up leaving the church or leaving the faith because there was no room. There was no ability for them to ask questions or to express doubt or to walk a journey through trying to understand what is healthy and what is first priority and what is second priority or maybe no priority in my faith. And whenever the church says things about them, like just an offhand remark about deconstruction, that pushes people away and further away from the church. It pushes them further away from the pastor. It pushes them further away from God. I understand it may be like value signaling to your people, rah, rah. You know, this is great. We're together. We're following Jesus. But what you're doing is people on the margins, you're saying, get out. Your questions, your presence isn't welcome here. You're either with us or against us. It's not that simple.
No. And which both Jesus and Paul, we see welcoming in folks in the margins, folks that didn't fit their subset of what they thought, and so it's infuriating to me that there's folks out there that are all like Paul. He tells this person and that person they're going to hell if they don't do this. That was not the Paul. That's not what Paul was about. Paul
was
about
it, Paul.
There's neither Jew nor Gentile. And on and on, that we are all welcome in the presence of Christ. He was the first all welcome guy, Paul. And that.
Yeah, I think Paul's been grossly misunderstood. I think it's fascinating because it's one of the worst kept secrets in Christianity that Paul has been grossly misunderstood. It's like you have to intentionally avoid understanding Paul in order to get to the misunderstandings that people do. And I think because it's so prevalent, the understanding of cultural context, whenever you just to scratch the surface, you don't have to go to like deep academic resources to understand what Paul is actually saying and how it translated to his original readers and then how that applies to us. No, you don't have to go that deep into it. That content is everywhere out there. And so people who kind of see Paul as being the opposite of what you just said are, I think, intentionally being closed-minded to Paul because they need to hold on to the mirage of who Paul is.
Yeah, they like, we talked about this last week some, they like to hold on to this subset of Christianity, their own version of Christianity, where they make it about morality, right? Which is fascinating. You know, they tend to focus more on the list of things Paul doesn't want us to do as followers of Jesus. But then they skip the part where Paul says, all of that following the law, I consider rubbish, right?
Yeah.
And then actually Paul's resume, if you will, is the ways in which he sacrificed, laid down his life for the church, for his friends, a lot like Jesus. So some of the differences, let's talk about some of the difference between Paul, I think, in Jesus. Paul, his version of salvation, generally, there's a lot of theories of salvation out there, but salvation is about, for Paul, about believing in the death and resurrection of Jesus. And then you could add in there, however you want to put it, you know, faithfulness to the law. And Paul talks a lot about that. One could say simply, Paul wrote, he talked about the do's and don'ts, what this looks like. And then Jesus lived. So Jesus lived out these things. And so Jesus's gospel was about loving God, loving neighbors, and bringing about the kingdom through love. And that love paves the way to resurrection. Ultimately, Christ's love, by laying down his life, his sacrifice, is what opened the door to resurrection. And that's how Jesus lived his life. So the way I was thinking about it is, Paul's kind of like the author who wrote it all down, and Jesus actually lived what Paul wrote, obviously in different orders there. But generally, that's kind of how I see it. I don't know if you had any.
Yeah, you know, I think there's so many different ways to read Paul and understand the connection and the disconnect between Paul and Jesus. So, yeah, I think that there are lots of different ways to kind of reconcile this difference between Paul and Jesus. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's just like there is no disconnect between Paul and Jesus. They're all saying, you know, they're both saying the exact same thing. For other people, I think it is, you know, Paul didn't write half of these anyway. We don't know who the authorship is. And so, you know, Paul was really taking Jesus' words in a whole different direction. And so most of Paul can just be ignored. And so, you know, I think that there's kind of two kind of ends of the spectrum there, at least ends of the spectrum that I consider to still kind of be within orthodoxy on some level. For me, I feel a little more comfortable with the middle road, and that's just me. I want to try to reconcile the letters from Paul, or the ones that are under Pauline title, with Jesus. I feel most comfortable doing that. And for better or worse, it seems as though, to the best of our understanding, the early church saw value in these letters enough to include them into the canon. And so for me, I try to do as much diligence as possible and go as far as possible in reconciling Paul and Jesus. And I kind of assume that if I can't make something reconcile between the two, then I'm the one who's not understanding what the cultural context is that Paul is writing into. Jesus on the surface is pretty clear. Paul is a lot more difficult usually in these passages to kind of understand what he's saying, because he tends to be a lot more contextual in how he's saying it than Jesus is. So I think your mousetrap is really great at that. You know, you look to Jesus for how to live it out, and Paul tends to kind of spell it out a little bit more clearly. But there are those moments where I come against things where I'm like, I don't know that Paul or my understanding of Paul really matches what I understand Jesus to be. And Jesus wins in those situations for me. I don't think that there's really any other way. Paul is not divine. The canon is not a member of the Trinity. I have to yield to the members of the Trinity at some point whenever there's conflict. And so I'll tend to go with Jesus. And usually those come down to Paul sometimes seemingly overly narrows what Jesus is teaching. And Jesus tends to lean towards a lot more inclusivity than religious folks are comfortable with. And whenever Paul seems to move towards an exclusivity that I feel would make Jesus uncomfortable, then I begin to kind of question and say, I'm not really sure that I'm understanding Paul here, or that he might not have taken this a little too far. And thankfully, Paul tends to give us contextual clues in the way he says things. If we're paying close enough attention, Paul usually will give us contextual clues as to where he's speaking from. You know, I believe this, or this is what I do, or this is how I lead, or I speak on behalf of God, or Jesus kind of gave this to me firsthand. So if we're really paying attention to Paul whenever he speaks things, it helps.
Yeah. And I think we forget, you know, by saying, you know, I believe the Bible in a sense is inerrant. And I think we have a podcast about inerrancy and we dove deep into that. But you hit it dead nail on the head. There's some folks that see it as perfect in every way, and they deify it, right? And that becomes a problem in these instances, because you do have to choose. You do have to choose, do I listen literally to what Paul's saying? Do I look to Jesus? And what happens is we miss the humanity in the scriptures, right? Paul, a lot of his, and a lot of scholars have said this, that Paul is in the midst of debates about what Jesus did meant for the church. And so he is sharing debates with us that maybe, like you hinted at this, but that might not necessarily be his opinion that he's adding to, or he's joining in the conversation. And we're not privy to those conversations because we weren't there, right?
Or, these letters aren't written to us. I was taught these letters are written to us. Paul knew, you know, everybody who wrote these things knew. Bullsh crap.
Yeah.
They weren't. Yeah. Okay. They weren't. And, you know, I heard the other day somebody said, well, Jesus wrote everything that was in the Bible. You know, like he essentially took Paul's hand and wrote it. I'm like, shit, no, he didn't. That's ridiculous. Shut up. That's not. The Bible doesn't anywhere say that nor imply it. It's stupidity. It's idolatry. It just doesn't match up. Like, come on. Let's be reasonable about what's going on here. Paul is writing contextual letters to the church. We're trying to read over the shoulders of somebody who wrote things 2,000 years ago in languages that we don't understand, in cultures that are long dead, that we don't live in, and trying to figure out what they, like, it's almost a nearly impossible task sometimes to really understand. And the fact that we have kind of been taught, many of us, especially who are in evangelicalism, that it's just as easy as reading English and you can understand everything that's in the Bible and everything that was intended, you know, everything that was heard in the first place and then everything that was intended, is they've really done us a disservice, quite frankly, and encouraged us to handle the Bible like an idol rather than a life-giving tool to help us see into the heart of God.
Yeah, and Paul is, he's responding to situations, right? So like, he is just reacting to different churches and what they're doing. Like, you know, the Corinthian church is having orgies in their services. So he's saying, stop doing that. Don't commit those sexual acts. Like, that's what he's doing. And then we take those list of things and we put our 21st century American context to it. And then we say, well, we must not be able to do A, B, and C. No, he was literally talking about these folks having orgies in church. Like, we don't do that here. Like, this is like not what we do. Even like the agape feast, when he says, don't get drunk on wine, that was a big one. he's talking to them at church, like, don't get drunk at church. Stop. Like, you're missing the point of why we partake in the communion elements, you know? And the list could go on and on and on. And
these are real letters about real problems in the church in that moment, in that context. And you have to begin, you're right, you have to begin by reading Paul in that way. It's highly contextual, even in a way that Jesus isn't. Jesus is definitely much more broadly speaking on spirituality and on Judaism and on the heart and the movement of God. And Paul has to have to redo those things. Paul is highly contextual, writing to a specific church with Pacific, Atlantic, Pacific, Atlantic, specific problems. And the Church of Corinth is a great example of the issues that he was dealing with there.
Yeah, we forget that. I think so. That's some of the reason for the do's and don'ts. I mean, a women in ministry is a big one, where we see Paul talk a little differently than how Jesus lived, and that's hugely contextual. But then, if you do a little research on Paul and how he actually lived, the way he lived when it came to women in ministry was a lot like how Jesus did it. And it seems like we ignore how Jesus and Paul actually acted when it came to women in ministry. And we just, you know, isolate a couple passages to bully people into submission, which is unfortunate and sad, and definitely not what Paul intended when he wrote. So that's one. I mean, that's hugely contested in our culture today amongst different theological positions. And
sometimes
it
just
way,
needs something to fight over, right?
And it's one big reason I think people deconstruct is the whole women in ministry thing. I think when someone grows up in an environment where you're putting women down, you're telling them to submit, they don't have an ability to speak, it kind of like, you kind of ask a question like, what, this doesn't seem right. And then when you actually study the scriptures and see how this actually played out and kind of where it was leading, because you have to remember they're in a context that was even more patriarchal than it is today, right? Women had zero rights. They could watch a murder and they could not be a witness to the murder because they're a woman. So it was even worse. And so Paul's, and even Jesus to an extent, is speaking to that culture. And so you have to understand that it's very different than today. But you can look at the trajectory that they're leading, that they want to empower women, that they see women as equals, as valuable, just by how they live their lives. And so when people see that, they deconstruct. They're like, well, yeah, if they were wrong about this, then what else were they wrong about? And they start asking questions.
That's exactly it. Whenever we lie about what scripture says to ourselves and then to others, or whenever we overstate what's said, and I think, you know, a lot of times on these topics, it's like we don't give the full truth about what was said, you know, that God does not allow women, you know, in ministry or to exercise any authority over a man. You know, I mean, the biggest middle finger to that is God and Jesus and Paul. You know, in the Old Testament, you look and see about the role of women in priestly ministry and leadership over men. You look at Jesus and the role of women in his ministry and the roles of leadership that he gave them. And then you look at Paul and some of the people in Acts and in the letters and the names and what the women are doing there. And it's like, that doesn't match up to what I have been told that God thinks or believes that the women ever in ministry or in leadership over men. Well, it just doesn't match up to scripture. So, you know, women in ministry, yeah, you're right. Whenever people begin to sniff out one or two exceptions to the thus saith the Lord that you've said, well, then it's like, okay, now I've got to figure this out. Were you being honest with me or am I misunderstanding this? And it's a rabbit hole, because then when they find out you shaded the truth, well, what else did you shade the truth about? What about Genesis and what it says? What about what it says about, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then people end up in this deconstruction where they literally have to, because evangelicalism, because pastors, because we have lied or bent the truth about what the Bible says and not given you the whole truth, we force people into essentially having to walk through every single one of the things that they have ever believed or that they've ever been taught about God and say, step by step, I've got to go through this one thing at a time and figure out where is truth and where is falsehood. And that's deconstruction. So it's not a surprise that pastors and churches would not want people going through deconstruction because, oh, they're going to realize that you've lied, that you've bent the truth in order to retain your power, to retain your control, or to keep me involved and keep me giving. Do people walk away from the faith because of deconstruction? Yes, they do, because they realize that they were lied to one too many times to be able to ever walk into a church or listen to a pastor ever again. And that's not their fault when they do. That's ours.
That's a good word.
Lie about Paul.
It's not their fault. Yeah. Stop bullying people. I mean, they're literally called the bully passages, right? Folks bully people. And here's the thing. I was thinking as you were talking that I have found, because we get called this, you more than me, because you're more active on the Twitterverse, but anti-biblical, or you don't believe the Bible, or you're not Bible-believing. I've found the more I deconstruct and dive into this, the more I love the scriptures, the more the scriptures come alive to me, the more Bible-believing I am. I think before I was less Bible-believing. I just, and in defense of some folks, they've never taken the time to actually study the Bible. They just regurgitate what they've heard, and it's very harmful, right? And so when you actually take the time to learn, you realize these things don't really line up.
Some of the greatest influencers on social media are the people who have the least amount of biblical knowledge or experience. And you can tell it in the way that they interact and the things that they say. It's whenever people say false doctrine, false prophet, you know, falling culture, itching ears, I just laugh. Projection, whatever. And in fact, we're trying to let people know that they need to not pay attention to you, to scare people away. I mean, all you're doing is just you're causing more people to tune in, because if you're saying these things, they're saying, what is it that he's saying that is making these people so angry? So, I mean, you know, you're advertising for me. You're advertising for Matt. You're advertising for deconstruction. Keep fun on people who need to hear truth and who need to find Jesus again, towards people who are asking the tough questions and not, you know, blowing smoke, you know, in your direction in order to try to trick you. I'll be honest with you about what it says and what it doesn't say. And that's scary for a lot of folks.
Yeah. It would be a good research project to see. I don't know if you could ever figure this out, but at least try to see how many people actually went through deconstruction because they heard influencers, megachurch pastors bash deconstruction and started to like, oh, let me see what this deconstruction thing is. And then it actually led them into deconstructing their faith. I wonder, I bet you quite a few, I bet it, you know, have done that. And I'm sure, yeah, when you shine a light on anything, it just draws attention, and you're not going to get the reaction that you think you're going to get. It forces people to, and I think this is why you and I go public with certain things, because it forces people to decide what they believe, right? What they think about it. Because if they hear something they're not sure about, they're going to go learn about it. They're going to go ask questions about it. And then they got to decide, do I believe Kevin and Matt or do I not? But when you're silent or you just regurgitate everything else that's been said before, no one has to make a decision. And a lot of folks like to live in that. They like to be a sheep. They like to, I don't want to make decisions. I just want to be told what to believe, what to do.
And I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to mark out your spiritual journey for you. I'm not going to tell you where you should go. I mean, I might help you if you need help along the journey, but that's not my role. I don't want to tell you what to believe. All that I want to do is try to help you understand not even what the Bible does say. I think it's fairly easy a lot of times to find out what the Bible does say. What's very difficult is finding out what the Bible doesn't say. Because for a lot of folks, they've been lied to about what the Bible doesn't say. So I spent a lot of my time kind of disabusing people of what the Bible doesn't say and helping them reframe terms and doctrines that you know, the Bible is the Word of God. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Yes, but.
Yeah.
And it's that but, that yes, but part that really gets under people's skin a lot of times. But that's what people need. People need space and ability to have an honest dialogue with people who will just say, yeah, it says that. No, it really doesn't say that. Can you make it say it? Maybe, but how disingenuous is it if you do? Or just simply, I don't know. It's really unclear. The Bible even seems, sadly, to be speaking against itself on this. One place it says this, one place it says that. You can try to reconcile it, or you can leave the dissonance there. What people want, I think, is somebody who is going to, they want a church. They want people around them who are going to just kind of be honest about what it says and then let them go from there. But to your point, there are a lot of folks out there who just aren't at the spiritual level where they're ready to do that. They want strong boundaries. They want everything to be black and white, and they want everything to be clear. And I understand that. I was there for a long time, and I think everybody in their faith is there for a long time, or is there at one point in their faith. It's usually at the very beginning. It's at the very beginning. And if we don't grow out of that kind of faith, I think that Hebrews would say that we're on milk, not solid food.
That's good. Yeah. I think that's why Paul gives a comfort to these folks, because a lot of his writing is very black and white. He's a very black and white writer, whereas Jesus is not black and white at all. No. Right?
Every time he got asked a question, he answered with three more questions, you know, right? Yeah. Like, you're not pinning Jesus in a corner. You know, he gave, what, three answers and asked 387 questions or something like that.
That's,
you know,
whenever
the only straight answer, really. Yeah, it is very Jewish. It's very rabbinical. The only straight answer that Jesus gave was in a story that, like an Aesop, for most people, that didn't make sense, you know, in a parable, you know, ask, who is my neighbor? Well, let me tell you a story. No, Jesus, I just wanted to know, you know, is it gay people? You know, are they my neighbor? You know, is it the ethnic minority that's trying to cross the border? You know, are they my neighbor? Well, let me tell you a story. No, Jesus.
Well, a good place for people to start when reading Paul and Jesus would be to read some rabbis and even go to your local synagogue and talk to the rabbi about the way he teaches, the way they dialogue about theology. Because they, as a culture, as a faith system, they believe strongly in two things not being able to be reconciled, debating them. And I don't, we don't give space for Paul to do that. Like, Paul, I think at times disagrees with stuff maybe Jesus said or did. And there's a tension there that I think is very human that we shouldn't neglect, and hold that intention and have the same debates and hold those things in tension and be okay with them. And so, yeah, I think we miss the Jewishness of the Bible. We try to Americanize it, and which is why I think people, a lot of Americans, gravitate towards Paul. He speaks more like an American than Jesus does, for sure. But yeah, I think hold things in tension. It's a beautiful thing, and we hold things in tension all the time in other areas. So why not some theology?
Yeah, that's a good word.
So let me see here. Some similarities. We talked a lot about that. I think we about covered it, at least what I had. I mean, we didn't cover everything, that's for sure.
Can you cover everything between Jesus and Jesus and Paul? It's a difficult conversation. It's a conversation that needs to be had. And it's also a conversation, though, that for a lot of us is very uncomfortable. And whenever we come to a discomfort with scripture, or whenever we come to a discomfort about what somebody is saying about scripture. A lot of times we feel like that discomfort comes from, oh, that other person is wrong. And I'm not so sure. A lot of times I think that the discomfort when we come to, like in this, you know, kind of chaos war between Jesus and Paul, is like, no, it's wrong to believe that there's any disconnect or dissonance there between the two of them. Well, maybe, but perhaps you should explore that discomfort and begin to say, why might I have discomfort at the idea that Paul and Jesus might not quite be the same person writing the same words and see eye to eye on everything? And I think that there's wisdom in that and everything that we come at in scripture. Whenever there's something that feels like, you know, I my blood pressure begins to rise, the hair on my back of my neck begins to stand up. Whenever I come against something that feels like it creates this tension inside of myself, this unease, maybe instead of just flat out putting the wall up against it, maybe it would be better for us to do what happens in the rabbinical and the Jewish tradition, is to say, let's sit with that and let's explore it. Let's think about that. Let's try to understand where that feeling of discomfort is coming from within us, and then maybe we can begin to get to a real positive spiritual answer to this, rather than just a, no, I'm right, everything I think is right, nothing that I believe can be wrong. Really?
Yeah. And that's a good place to go with this, is like to be open-handed, to be a learner. And I think ultimately to keep Jesus at the center, you know, we get blamed for not being good hermeneutically because, you know.
Why don't you take a hermeneutics class, Kevin? Yeah. Which of the seven would you like to talk about that I've taken?
I know. I laughed when I saw that.
But maybe you should learn hermeneutics. Yes. Maybe I should. Yes. Yeah. Tell me about your homeschool. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Have you seen that guy on TikTok? He's like a youth pastor at a larger church. I don't know where, but he like makes fun of evangelical megachurch homeschooling culture. He's kind of a chubbier guy. I'll have to send you some videos. He's hilarious. He's hilarious. But yeah, it's good to laugh at ourselves. But yeah, so I think we would subscribe to a Jesus hermeneutic, that we read Paul through Jesus, that if we have a question, we go to Jesus. And then if that doesn't answer it, we just kind of live in the tension, and we live in the ability to know that we don't know everything, and continue to ask questions, and God can take your questions, right? Go to the Holy Spirit dialogue. Richard Rohr calls it a divine dance, the Spirit of God, right? His Father, Son, Spirit invites you into that dance to join him, to participate. So, you know, don't just do it because you always have thought it or always were told a certain way. Ask those questions. So some news, shifting gears. This week, there was a little bit of a, and it kind of goes well with some of the topic we talked about in the beginning about deconstruction. People just want to deconstruct because they want to have sex, fill in the blank of with who. So a lot of conservatives, those who are more on the fundamentalist side, kind of rip those of us that have deconstructed for that a lot. There's a lot of like boogeymaning, there's a lot of needling, you know, calling names or making being gay a name, right? Like you're gay, as a name calling, which is very inappropriate. And they know that's inappropriate too. Anyways. So they come against anybody not of their sexual persuasion and even their sexual belief, as someone who's kind of a pedophile maybe, or they'll call them all sorts of names related to sexuality. It happens a lot. And yet, then the flip side, obviously they're very hypocritical. On the flip side, they'll do something or things very similarly or even worse, and think it's just a joke or it's fine, it's whatever. So anyways, that gives some context. I don't know if you wanted to share the tweet from our friend Joshua.
Do I want to share it? I don't know. Let me see if I can put it up here. Yeah, so there's this...
You can just talk about it.
There's this... so Joshua Hames, who is, you know, this young guy who's trying to be the poster boy now for Christian nationalism and patriarchy, post this video of his son mouthing a cup of Mountain Dew, I think, and post this joke about him French kissing and teaching his baby, you know, there in the picture to French kiss. And then, you know, I think it says next, I just need to teach him how to woo a lady. Joshua is one of the main people out there in alt-right evangelical Christendom who's calling people perverts, you know, anything having to do with LGBTQ, anything, you know, having to do with that as a pervert, you know, using the word groomer for everything but what the word groomer is. And he gets called out. He gets called out by Tim Whitaker at the New Evangelicals, who just kind of says, for a guy who is always talking about folks in drag sexualizing children and labeling people groomers, this is pretty bad, you know, to post this joke, you know, about your son French kissing a woman and then teaching him how to woo a lady in this way. And it just kind of, it blows up. Josh blows up at Tim at the New Evangelicals. Tim doubles down. It got real messy real fast. I don't know how much of it you saw, but it was quite a conversation for a few days.
Yeah, it took over my feed. Every time I opened, the algorithm would send that into my feed. You summarized it well. I think so. Tim called out Joshua for being hypocritical, and in the context of everything, especially in the conversation, very inappropriate. The very least, even if he thought it was funny, Joshua, and it's a joke, you don't publicly post that knowing what the context is and what you've talked about consistently, right? I just think it just doesn't line up. If I was on his side, I would be like, dude. And it sounds like he had some people tell him that, because then he issued a non-apology apology.
An apology, an evangelical apology.
I apologize to Tim, but here's why I'm justified for doing what I did.
I apologize you got offended at a joke, was essentially what it says, and then doubled down on he would not apologize for calling, you know, use the word perverts over and again in the apology, and double down on again sexualizing women, sexualizing his child. It was kind of crazy, because then it became this, like, a lot of folks were defending, you know, Tim for calling Josh out and saying, you know, this is good. We have to call these things out. We cannot allow any sexualization of children or women in the church. And this does both. So Joshua apologizes without apologizing, and Tim rolls over, you know, and essentially says, all right, accept his apology. You know, I take it at face value. You know, he's apologized. And everyone's like, wait a minute, he didn't apologize at all for this. He didn't back off of anything that you said that he had done. And so it just didn't pass the smell test. But if you read deeper, I don't know. You know, in fact, Tim responded to one and said, yes, that's why he didn't want to make a bigger deal of it. He wanted it to drop. He wanted to be the bigger man. But I think that there was one more reason of why Tim did it. And it was clear from a couple of the back and forths that Tim wants Joshua to come and do an interview, do a conversation with him. And so the only path forward, essentially, if you read through the context of the transcripts, is Tim had to back down, or else it would be a closed door for having a conversation with Joshua at some later point about theology. And to me, whatever, accept the apology, move on, do it for the wrong reasons or whatever, move on. But to do it for the sake of boosting your base or your reach by having a conversation with a guy who's legit out there calling you and other people perverts for defending your belief of what the scripture says on LGBTQ issues, and for asking for reasonable communication and verbiage when it comes to drag and homosexuality, and not mixing up words like groomer and pervert with things that aren't that. Don't muddy the water with words. I think Tim did a real disservice, frankly, to himself, to his movement that he's a part of. And I was disappointed.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head with everything. And I think when we compromise our values, you know, to try to, you know, people please, that's essentially it. You know, at the very least. And then, you know, you go down the road of kind of reading some context and know, all right, he's doing this because he wants, he's doing A because he wants B to happen, isn't healthy either. And then two, like, just practically, you're never going to win with a guy like Joshua. Like, if he actually goes on Tim's podcast or Tim joins him on his podcast, it's just going to be an ambush. Like, Tim's not going to win. Joshua is going to make sure he has the home court advantage, because now Tim's put himself at a disadvantage because Joshua knows he folded. Yeah. Joshua knows that he didn't apologize and Tim just took it. And so, you know, Joshua has the high ground, if you will, in that conversation and is going to take advantage of it. He's a smart guy. He knows what he's doing. If he were to agree to it, I don't even know that he would, but it won't go well. It won't go the way Tim thinks it will. Because I've seen him do others of these interviews, and they don't, to me, like, I get maybe, like, if there's a non-selfish heart behind it, I get, like, you want to reach across the aisle and try to, you know, win them over, if you will. But I think a better approach for all this is actually just to speak to your base, just build your base, the actual people that you have a voice to. Like, you don't have a voice to Joshua. You're not going to be the guy that gets him to change. Like, you're just not, because you're an online personality he's connected with on Twitter. Like, come on. So
no, yeah, no, you're right. It's sad, and I see this. This is a bigger issue than Tim, and I don't necessarily want to nail this, you know, to Tim's coffin, because I don't know Tim, so I don't know if this describes Tim. But what I see happen a lot of times here is that people who were conservative fundamentalists tend to bring their conservative evangelical fundamentalistic ways into progressivism. So after folks kind of move and cross that line from toxic fundamentalism and conservative camps, they come into more progressive camps, but they don't let go of, they don't disentangle, I'm intentionally avoiding the word deconstruct, they don't disentangle all of those power and empire and desire for influence that they have over here in fundamentalism. They bring that into progressive spaces. And so what I see is a whole lot of the same thing in fundamentalism and in progressivism and even further over in liberal areas when it comes to the way they folks interact. And so, you know, this, if it was fairly clear that Tim in this instance backed down in order to maintain influence or to grow influence. In fact, a large part of the conversation between them had to do with influence and who had the greater influence and whose influence could overwhelm the other. That's toxic evangelicalism from top to bottom. And I see it all the time, that the good old boys clubs from fundamental conservatism, white men, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, is brought over into progressive spaces, and it's just as shitty as it was in the conservative spaces. And it makes me so angry, so frustrated to see that, because it is, it's going to mean the end of a lot of these folks' influence and the ideals that may be more sound or maybe more biblical, I believe, than conservatism. They're not going to get anywhere with them because they're still trying to utilize the same toxic things that infiltrated conservative values. Now they're bringing it to their progressive values and their progressive spaces. And those spaces are toxic as well, which is why a lot of people, you know, kind of are in progressivism for a while and then they back away from it and are like, I can't do this either. It's not a lot of times because of the theology as much as it is because of the people who are there. I don't like the smell of that, yeah, from Tim, because it smells like that. Whether or not it was, and whether or not Tim is that way, I don't know, but it smells like that. And I don't like things that smell like that. I expect it in conservatism, and it makes me very angry at progressivism, because it's the antithesis of what you said whenever you disentangled all of those things from evangelicalism. You said that that was one of the things that was frustrating to you. But then when you came over into this space and then become somebody who has influence or has a voice, now you've drunk the same thing that the other people, you know, you've become what you hated.
Is it that you detangled from that because you didn't like it, or because you weren't one of them?
That's a good point. And it's one of the reasons why I think so many fundamentalists on both sides hate me. I think you as well. It's one of the reasons why people in progressive circles are not a fan of me any more than people in conservative spaces aren't, because I don't play the game. Like, I'm not going to get involved in that. I don't care whether or not progressives like me. I don't have to be sharing the stage with you or scratching the back of you. I'm not going to play the game.
It's not me.
And I know it. I don't make y'all angry, because I'm not going to make you feel good about yourself by treating you like you want to be treated, because you've got this big name or this following. I just don't care. To me, you're just another person, and I love you. I might dislike what you're saying. I'm not going to treat you any differently, no matter who you are.
Yeah, that's good. It is fascinating to see all these progressive groups have conferences. Not that getting together for conferences is bad, but it just reinforces the point you're making about it's just repackaged evangelicalism. Nothing has really changed, I cracked up because I saw a few of them get promoted this past week, and it just feels very, capitalistic, I guess. Because I think one of the things, at least that I've deconstructed, is like trying to keep capitalism out of the church. But like you said, it's a smell test, because it's not bad to gather together and be like-minded.
No, it's not bad. Like, it's not bad. It's not bad to sell deconstructive resources. Like, it's not, I don't think it's bad to make money, it's not bad to support yourself off of, what you're doing.
Feed your family,
whatever. But like you said, it's a smell test that people can often, like, they can smell it. They can root it out. Any normal person can tell whether or not you are authentic, whether or not you're legitimate, or whether or not your primary motivation is something other than something that is, what's the word I'm looking for? Whenever your primary motivation is something other than just the good of the content or the good of Christ, people can see that. They can tell it. Yeah. And it will have an effect. You're going to have a ceiling, or you're going to, like Tim did with Joshua Hames, you're going to eventually implode because your ego outruns your character.
Yeah. I was just thinking about one of the first progressive or ex-evangelicals, Rob Bell, right? And I think he's someone who does it well. Whatever you think about Rob Bell, he produces content. He lives off his content, right? He still does that full time. But he doesn't like he provides the content and he says, here's my content I'm providing and how I'm providing it. Take it or leave it, right? He's not like shoving in your face. He's not just creating these events to try to make money with the same repackaged content from before. For him, it's all new, fresh stuff that he's bringing. And I think that's where it's at. Like, where is your heart at? Like, if you're getting people together because you have something new to say, God's impressed something, you're learning something new, you want to get it out there, you want to have a conversation with some people. But for me, I think the smell test is like when I just see what's repackaged from other places by someone who's an influencer. Yeah, no, you're right. That's it.
You know, Richard Rohr is a similar name. You know, whenever you said Rob Bell, I thought Richard Rohr. There are these people out there who are true, I think, leaders in the space, who are true thinkers in the space, and who are delivering powerful content and challenging things, even if you don't fully agree with them all the time. They're out there thinking and producing and utilizing their gifts in order to move the ball down the field. And I love what you said about, I think you used the word repackaging. There, you've got this other group of people out there who are simply just taking what other people are doing and trying to piggyback off of that to make their star, you know, rise. They don't produce really any content of their own. They're just utilizing other people's content. You know, I see people do that fairly regularly, even with myself. You know, I'll post something and then within 24 hours, I'll see two or three of these other folks repackaging that same content, you know, and putting it out there as their own. And sometimes they get 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times as many likes as I do on mine. Whatever, but there's no integrity there. I'm like, there's absolutely no way that you had that same idea. Yeah. You know, it's like within 24 hours, like literally you know, and it's like, okay. I mean, everybody I think probably does that a little bit. Hey, this person had this idea. I like that. I'm going to take this in this different direction and talk about it. That's not what I'm talking about. But, you know, have some integrity, have some authenticity, be comfortable in your own skin and speak to what you have expertise in. And if you're in a field, if you're in a field, you know, if you've become an influencer, you know, if your voice has been raised in any of these circles beyond what you have the ability to actually maintain legitimately in your academics or your thinking or your experience, then you have two choices, really. You can either get the experience or the training or the understanding, the education to meet the level that your voice is at, or you can just continue pretending, and that's not going to go well for you or for the kingdom.
Yeah, good word. Yeah, it's a good place to land the plane today.
So you've been hitting it hard, right? From what I heard last week, you said, you know, been hitting the weights hard, been hitting the gym hard, been cracking down on the food intake, which sucks, but how's it going?
Pretty good. I drink a lot of sparkling water. Today's choice is Topo Chico. It's going well.
I get it. I've got, you know, this Coke Zero.
I grabbed some of those too.
Here. Yeah, I was getting it at Walgreens just before we came here, and this, like, I have my earbuds in and this dude's like hitting me on the shoulder, like trying to get my attention in line. And I'm like, okay. So I pull my earbuds out. He looks at me, he's like, you just come from a workout or going to a workout? I was like, just came from a workout. He said, do you drink those things? Yes, I drink those things. He's like, I can't drink those things. I'm like, well, it's zero calories. It's my only vice. I said, it's that or methamphetamines. It just kind of gives me this look. Just put my earbuds back in.
That's so good.
End scene.
Yeah. I need to get better at that. That's so good.
But yeah, I mean, we all have our vices, right? So
That's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. So how's it going? So,
pretty good. I'm feeling good. Today was back on the RX train. Did well in the gym. Felt good about that. Top right now. I'm top three in the gym.
You always. It's amazing. I mean, you kill it. You've been killing it for years.
If it's the right workout. Today was the right workout, so I went for it. Like I said, when you get older, you just pick your spots. But I went for it today, and yeah, when you, like I said, I've been saying like last couple of weeks, when your diet gets in line, like you just feel better, and you can, I most feel it in the gym for sure. Yeah, I'm down about, I don't know, 12-ish pounds.
Dude, that's amazing.
Still got a long way to go.
There's always more to go. You don't focus on that.
No, there's always more to go.
You focus on the that's amazing. Congrats.
So, yeah, thanks. We'll see. We'll see how long it takes me before I'm, when I decide to do some maintenance for a while. About a month in, so at least two more months of this diet, and then I'll figure out what's next. But
don't stop, just keep going.
Just keep going, yeah. You get your RP certificate? Like,
yes, they want you to, I know. RP says 3 months. That's it. 3 months, and then going to maintenance. Yeah. I guess as long as you come out of maintenance and back into weight loss, then that's fine. You know, or whatever's next, muscle building, weight loss, whatever. But
No, I won't stay on maintenance for long, but I feel like I've learned over time. Yeah, your body kind of, it gets comfortable. And so you kind of have to, you know, increase your calories a little bit to, it's kind of tricking your body, I feel like.
Yeah, it's, as much as I know about the body, I feel the same way about the body as I do about the Bible. The more I learn about the Bible, the less I realize I know about the Bible. Same thing about the body. The more I learn, you know, through certifications and these things, the less I realize I actually know about it. So,
and everybody's different too.
Well, so, you know, the same thing. Everybody who knows nothing is an expert in theology, and everybody who knows nothing, you know, in fitness and weight loss is an expert in fitness and weight loss. Like the guy who's like, "Hey, really drink that?" But,
Yeah,
I do.
Well, it's funny because like I see a lot of these ads now. Like algorithms are amazing. They know that I'm dieting, even though I guess I've said it on here. But they throw all these like people with diets, and they'll be like, "You never have to stop eating donuts and burgers or drinking beer and all these things, right?" And I'm like, dude. That's such bad advice. That's so awful. You know, that might work for 1% of the population who has just a super high metabolism and they process carbs really well. But for most of us, you know, we don't process carbs super well. So we got to, you know, stay away from that if we want to drop weight.
Yeah, I tell you, though, it's weird, man. I still continue to lose weight and to lose inches around the waist, which I found is actually the plan right now I asked my trainer, I'm like, okay, what's going on? Should I be losing weight or should I be gaining weight? Because I keep losing weight and you keep adding food. So I'm like, this is kind of counterintuitive. You keep adding more food and I keep losing weight. And it was like this week, I lost another pound or two overall from the week before and lost like a half an inch off the waist. And he comes back and he's like, "We're going to add more carbs." And I was like, which, you know, the list of things that I eat is very small. From him. So what that means is essentially adding a whole other scoop of rice on every plate of food on top of the like three big scoops of rice that I'm already eating. And somebody, a family member walked in and saw the plate of food that I was eating and was like, did a double take. It's like, "You're eating all of that?" I'm like, I can barely eat all, like I have to force myself to get it down because it's so much food and so many carbs. And it's counterintuitive. So I was like, what's going on? He's like, you know, and I understand this, but I don't understand it too. It's like, well, your body is clearly burning calories very well right now. So we're just feeding the fire and we're going to keep upping the calories and the carbs that we're giving you as long as your workouts are really hard and as long as your body continues to lose weight. So there is like this real counterintuitive thing where it's like I'm eating more food and yet continuing to lose weight and seeing changes in the mirror positively from it. So I don't pretend to understand it, but it works.
I was there once. It is a fascinating experience. And it has to do with the intensity of your workouts. Like if you stop working out, building that muscle, because it's your muscle, right? The muscle at rest builds more or burns more calories. It is fascinating because I was on that plan with my coach at CrossFit in Pennsylvania, and I was pretty lean. And the same thing, he kept adding carbs and carbs and but not everybody can do that. Like, right. Like that's the thing, like these popular ads, those that are fit and have the right workout routines can do that. But those that are just starting out or have 50 to 60 pounds to lose, like that's not where you start. So,
In fact, he said, tell me what your cheat meal is. Cause I get one cheat meal a week. He was like, tell me what your cheat meal is. Because I want to make sure you're getting enough food, enough calories during your cheat meal. And I was like, well, actually, I have like 2.5 medium-sized cheat meals. I'm cheating on my emails. I'm cheating on my cheat meals. It was like, Saturday morning, I have pancakes and syrup for breakfast with the family. And then, Friday night is family pizza night, and we make homemade pizza. So it's like, and Sunday after church, sometimes we eat Mexican. Every week, so I'm like, I know at some point I'm going to have to like stop cheating on my cheat meals. And he's like, well, as long as you're continuing to lose weight, whatever, just keep shoving calories in. It's like that I can do. I am an expert. Awesome. Like I have a doctoral degree in shoving food in my mouth. I'm an expert.
That's great. Congrats, man. That sounds fun.
It is until you have like literally 4 cups of rice on your plate 3 times a day. And then it's like.
No, I know what you mean. I was on a diet once where they were just having me eat a certain number of grams of vegetables per meal. And it was a lot. It was like almost a whole plate load of like vegetables. And it worked because you get super stuffed and you'd be there and you'd be like really trying hard to squeeze it in. You're like, I don't know if I can eat this carrot again. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll see where you are next week.
All right, man. Well, good job. Keep eating that Mexican. Keep cheating.
Well, that's free chips and salsa. So what are you going to do? If you eat it on Sunday, it's not cheating. It doesn't count.
No, calories don't count on Sunday.
Somewhere in Leviticus.
Or your birthday.
Speaking of birthday, you've got somewhere to be. So, all right. Yeah. It's good to see you, man. Take care.
Yeah, fun times. Take care.